let's go ahead and get started. One of the things that's going to be helpful for me is to know a little bit about who you are. And that names are hopeless, so don't tell me your name. I won't remember it, and but I might remember where you're from and something interesting about you. How many of you are from Washington State?
Originally or currently?
Well, they're currently, maybe. Where are you from currently?
Currently Washington State.
Currently
originally
Washington
New York
State.
City.
There seem to be a lot of Washington people here. That'd be interesting. Seattle?
Seattle-ish.
That's what I should say, is Seattle-ish?
Yeah.
What does that mean, Seattle-ish?
Metropolitan area.
Metropolitan area, okay.
National Island.
How many of you are sort of urbanite Washingtonians?
Oh,
anybody consider themselves rural?
Okay.
Touche. Yes, touche. Okay. How many retired? That's looking more and more attractive to me. How many still working? How many still enjoying it? Okay, that's good. That's good. So what other states besides Washington?
Washington, D.C.
Washington, D.C.? Holy cow. Well, I'm from Pennsylvania, so.
We're close.
We're close, yes.
The other white meat.
Minnesota.
How many men? Okay, Minnesota is like state number two for...
First city on the Mississippi. Bemidji, Minnesota.
Bemidji?
Yes.
Why do I know Bemidji? My wife's from Minnesota. Why do I know Bemidji?
Because I had an uncle and aunt kind of
school there. Okay. All right. So Bemidji, Minnesota. Any other Minnesotans? Yes, that's right.
Moorhead.
Where do you
live in Fargo?
Live in Fargo. Okay. So DC, we got Minnesota, any other states?
Idaho. Three of us from Boise.
Cool. Which panhandle?
No, Boise.
Down in Boise.
Southwest.
Okay. I've only driven across Idaho. Don't know really that much about it as a state. This is the first major thing I've ever done in Washington State. Any other states represented?
South Carolina.
Mm-hmm. We did Charleston a couple years ago. It's a wonderful city.
Yeah. Next to Paris.
I think probably I'd choose Paris, but.
Then another day in Charleston.
Okay. Academics. Any sort of questions starts someplace. And we'll talk about this a little bit later when we get to this idea of modeling God. But as human beings, we have no view from nowhere. Archimedes was right. He was both right that if you give him a place to stand and a lever long enough, he could move the earth. The problem is there's no place out there to stand. There's no Archimedean viewpoint from which we can come at stuff, which is why we're trapped in dialogue. Talking to one another. And if we talk long enough, we can come to comprehension and understanding of each other. So really you need to know a little bit about me so that you can understand what we end up doing and talking about. I grew up as a Nebraska farm boy on a small working farm, which makes me an official nearly extinct species. Okay, a very, very small percentage of the American population, even the rural population, that actually still live on working farms. I grew up in a small town, a 230 population. So that's a part of who I am. My faith journey really started as a Jesus freak about 1969. So if you remember anything, how many of you remember the 60s? Okay. I keep telling my college students that I am a gift to them so that they'll understand their grandparents.
Yeah.
And that, I mean, that experience deeply, deeply marks the way in which I go about theology, about my relationship to the church. I carry with me still, out of the late 60s, an apprehension for institutional structures, institutional authority. Just ask my college president. All of those sorts of things are a part of that. I'm denominationally identity challenged. I grew up Evangelical United Brethren, then we became United Methodists, and I did the Jesus Freak thing, then I was hung out with Episcopalians and Charismatic Catholic nuns and Independent Baptists, and I went to college in Oklahoma. Did my graduate work, got my doctorate in Britain, where I was a member of the Church of England for 5 years. Came back, and there were no teaching jobs, so I took a Methodist church, ended up getting ordained as a Methodist. Had a social justice falling out with my bishop and kind of said, no thank you, Methodists. And went on staff at a large membership Lutheran ELCA church in Nebraska. Started teaching at Midland Lutheran, what was then Midland Lutheran College. I taught there for a number of years, taught at the University of Nebraska at Omaha, and then on to Susquehanna University in Seelands Grove. So that's a little bit of kind of where I come from. Some of my lifelong passions have been science and religion, which we're going to do a lot of today. So, and we want to begin exploring sort of what are the formative kinds of issues and things that begin to shape your understanding of God and what it is that evolution and particularly quantum cosmology might give us as ways of sort of trying to reimagine God. If I try to touch base with the language that Glenn is using in his sessions, and Joe is going to be doing on evolution in his sessions. So we're going to start this with a group activity. Everybody knows how to play in groups, right? So I'd like you to find, make a sort of self-contained group of 5 or 6. That means you have to move.
Okay, your first assignment is to finish that sentence.
All right, so first of all, sort of 3 or 4 minutes just brainstorming. What are different things you put in that blank to complete the sentence? And then among your group, try to prioritize, though, well, 5 or 6 things first, then we'll go to the second part. God is like, all right, it looks like every, these two groups have 5 or 6 already. Everybody have some, have a list they can make choices from. All right, so the second part of this is to prioritize the two that you think express the most essential aspect of God. All right. If you want, whoever vacated the comfy chairs could go back for a little while now, sort of focus back in. We're going to unpack what it is you did. So why don't we start here? Give me one.
First try?
Yeah.
Energy.
God is like energy.
Oh, I like that. I like that.
Okay. So is a 2-year-old. God is like love.
One. Okay. God is like light.
Like light. Okay. Where are we?
A storm followed by a rainbow.
That's really interesting.
We had an interesting
group. Atmosphere.
What, sorry?
Atmosphere.
God is like atmosphere. On what class of planet?
Jupiter.
This is kind of like two parts. Nothing else / everything else.
Ooh, that's a very Buddhist answer. But really interesting for what we're doing here. Everything, nothing.
Else. Everything else and nothing else. Did I say that right? Right. Yeah, that's right.
The else is important?
Yes.
It's like nothing else, not like nothing.
Right.
Yes, that's right. It is important.
Yeah. Okay. How did you, I'm interested to hear how you came up with these ideas.
I didn't.
What began to generate them?
We just started throwing things out.
But remember, everybody starts from somewhere. So where is it you're starting from that gets you to throw these kinds of things out?
I think there were a couple different groups in our group, and there were a couple of some beginning conventional things, and there were some playful ideas that crept in. And
that's an interesting pairing, conventional and playful.
Mm-hmm. Well, there were some things that were sort of like, I think that one would say this, and we added some things, and then there were some playful ideas that got brought into the conversation.
Could I add that? From a sense of place, where I am right now, I threw in the playful things.
Yes.
Because of a sense of place.
Meaning, what do you mean by place?
Right here.
This physical place.
Yes.
Okay. I find as I get older, I'm more playful with God. When I was a young man, the only thing that mattered was being right.
Yeah.
And winning all the theological arguments, and now it's much more mysterious, and that's one of the privileges of this getting older stuff. How do these speak to your relationship to God?
I had both the atmosphere, and I put in the word Jesus. Can't see, but I don't know very much about God apart from Jesus either.
Yeah, I mean, I'm asking you to think about God, not Jesus here.
Yeah, I understand.
But I like that idea that you can't know much apart from the expression of God in Christ.
Right.
Okay. How does this speak to your relationship?
The things that brought ideas to life for me were things I had experienced in my own historical sense and life up to this point.
Okay. And God, so experiences with love, and then you extrapolate that into God?
What I know from my own experience, or list any of those up there.
Okay.
I was going to say, to me, only the love one is kind of a human, emotional type of thing, and the rest of them are all something else.
Right, many of these are quite sort of the broader natural environment way of thinking, which, given, again, our physical setting, is a way in which I sort of expect you to be more expansively thinking about God than perhaps you might normally in your normal setting. Now, where I want to go with this is an idea that theologian David Tracy calls the analogical imagination. And the basic idea is that human beings have evolved to be symbolic creatures. Our minds are programmed to think in symbol systems. Whereas it appears as though, at least we think we know, that most other animals think much more sort of concretely and specifically. So when the deer are looking at you, they're not thinking about the human race. They're thinking about, well, that one sort of looks a little bit like that one. And they don't appear to be a threat, so I don't really care. And why are they staring at me? That they're not processing symbolic, meaningful sort of stuff. But we have evolved as probably one, maybe the only animal, not more than a small percentage of higher mammals, who can do symbolic thinking. Which means that when we think about God, we think about God symbolically. And we do it through analogies with experience. You were the person talking about experience. So we draw from an experience in our lives or an experience with nature, and then we extrapolate that to make models of God. There are a couple of... So real quickly, the second thing on your list.
Ours was home.
Home.
Mm-hmm.
Ooh, that's... I got to write that one down. Okay, home.
Source? Mystery.
Agatha Christie, okay.
We had lots of words. A bee buzzing over growing green grass.
God is grass. Okay. Not the kind that's legal in Washington.
Air.
How's that different from atmosphere? Or is it different?
Atmosphere is a lot more than air.
Ah, that's interesting. Okay, your second one.
We had several that kind of felt in the category of parent. We did brooding chicken and mother, and then...
I remember hearing some group talk about mother, maybe father came up, so some sort of parent thing. Now, I'm finding here some that are I may have expected a little bit more strongly. I really expected love to show up on the list. Energy is interesting because that's a power, a force that we think of and that we experience in the world around us. All of us grew up, hopefully, in a home, and home shapes us. That's happening on Wednesday. Source is this idea of God as the origination of things, which perhaps ties to the idea of energy. So I might have expected to hear the word power somewhere, that God is a sort of ultimate power in the universe. Perhaps that's even a little bit behind the idea of mystery. Well, where I'm going with that bee hovering over the grass thing is God really likes life.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. L'chaim. Okay. It was interesting the way in which you distinguished atmosphere. This is more intimate, isn't it? So the intimate connection with God. Whereas atmosphere is this kind of thing that scientists do, right? And parent. God is a parent. Now, oftentimes, what ends up getting focused in these are ideas of safety, which I was a little surprised we didn't have God as a parent keeps us safe. So we got the idea of safety in that. The idea of, maybe it's in this one, of control. So let's real quickly recap this idea of analogy. When we think about God, and this has been long in theology, it goes at least back to Augustine, Aquinas in the Middle Ages, the medieval theologians, talk about analogical theology. I can never know God the way God knows God. I can never know God in God's self. I can only know God in those ways that God touches me, or in those ways that God touches my people, right? And a lot of that is going to be drawn in analogy. So if God is going to appear to me, God has to appear, if I see a vision of the Virgin Mary, she's got to appear in wavelengths that are designed to interact with my retina. If she appears at an ultraviolet level far beyond me, that's not going to work very well. If God can somehow speak directly into my neurons, God would have to do that using neural pathways that are already there. If God tries to talk to me in my brain with neural pathways that I don't have, it's not going to compute. Our humanity limits the way in which we can think about God. There's a Star Trek, I'm a Trekkie. I suppose I should have said that at the beginning. No, so if you want to leave now, that's okay. There's a really famous Star Trek episode where Kirk and Spock run into these aliens that are totally without any human analogy, and they can't. It's just sort of like you're suddenly in a totally different universe. And so what the aliens do is adjust their appearance. And they specify this in the script. They adjust their appearance to something that human beings can interact with and understand. Now, if we were doing something about the incarnation, that begins to say a lot about God choosing to become human in Christ and speak to us in that specific way. Analogical thinking is all that we can do. Now, there's a danger to it, because it means that my original sin, God is like, not God is. God is like energy. God is not energy. Getting at that everything else, nothing else sort of idea. God is like light, but God isn't exactly photons, right? The danger is that we will reify our analogies and turn them into facts rather than mediums that God is using to begin to develop relationship with us. And when we reify them as factual, we begin to get our thinking about God locked up. So one of our starting points here is that science, particularly 20th century science, offers us some new experiences of the natural world that can inform the way in which we begin to build models of God. Now, part of what's also a background for this is an idea, John Polkinghorne, Anglican priest, theoretical physicist at Cambridge University, calls critical realism, that our theology should match up with our experience of the created world. Now, this basic idea goes all the way back in the history of theology to what's called natural theology. So how many of you are artists? So when you do something artistic, you put part of yourself into that work, right? So if God created a universe at which the base level is energy, a universe full of photons, a universe full of storms and rainbows, a universe full of bees and grass, there's something true about God that's shown in that artwork. Something that comes across. Now, if we're trying to build models of God that conflict with what we can know about the created order, that's kind of a red flag, and maybe we ought to go back and try to rethink the theology. We'll come up with some specific examples later. Now I'd like you to focus back in your groups for a bit. And your assignment is, what out of the Old Testament, what are the major models of God that are presented? How is God spoken of in the Old Testament? All right, I've been around and you've all already got five or six things. How many of you would like to enroll as college students next fall? I mean, I give them this and it takes them 20 minutes to come up with one thing. So focus back in now. Shoot.
Which one did you
do,
on all of them or just one?
Couple.
God as ruler.
Ruler.
Liberator.
Liberator.
Caller.
Caller.
One who calls.
Interesting. Okay. A couple.
Creator.
Creator.
Covenant
seeker. Ooh, covenant.
Covenantor. King.
King.
We have judge going along with the, yeah.
Punisher. Law. Giver.
Ooh, excellent. Lawgiver.
Provider.
You have a second?
Well, warrior.
Oh, thank you.
Voice.
God is a voice.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good
one. Ooh, the literary critic wants
yeah,
to
that's
run
what
with
we
that
were
one.
For.
The other ones are already up there.
The other ones are already up there. Anything on your list that's not here you think is really important?
I am. That I am.
I am.
Boss man.
Boss man.
And that's actual ancient Hebrew. roughly.
You're fired.
Okay.
We have father.
Father.
Yep.
Godfather.
Werner.
Yeah, I okay.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
Throw it up.
Werner.
Oh,
Werner.
Oh,
that's true.
Uh-huh. I. Can we save that one till we get to quantum mechanics? All right. Now, notice that imagine yourself to be living 3,000 years ago. Life is precarious. Much of what you experience on a daily basis is fear. Notice how many of these biblical images focus around a protector, protection. So I was surprised that we didn't come up with God is a rock. God is Luther's mighty fortress.
Shepherd.
The other thing that is very precarious is that what would happen here in the village if the food supply got cut off? I don't know how often you get in supplies, but if you missed one of those,
trouble.
Okay, so if food source is precarious, notice that we've got. God as a provider, which is also something you'd expect from a king and a ruler, to be able to provide food as well as protection. Kings provide laws. And what happens to you if the state patrolman finds you going too fast?
Punished.
The law, the ruler, the are there to judge and punish. So these are out of their politics, out of their understanding of their needs, fundamentally toward protection and guidance. But we also see God as a source, again, the creator. All of these tie into that, didn't you come up with energy?
Yeah.
Somebody did energy. That God is a power. All right. These are very common in the ancient Near East. And in fact, I want to do one common model which is associated with the Genesis story that you came up with. Have any of you heard of the Enuma Elish, the Babylonian creation myth? Okay, this is my rendition of the Enuma Elish. In the beginning was stuff. Possibly the quantum void. And the stuff roughly differentiates into fresh water and salt water. So as scientists, what they're seeing is the essential sort of component out of which everything else is structured is water. Fresh water and salt water. The fresh water is Apsu, the male figure. No, I got that wrong. Apsu is the salt water. Tiamat is the fresh water. So, what happens when a mama god and a papa god go bump in the night?
Water.
You get baby gods. And so the other part of their science here is that they imagine or they understand sexual power to be at the very heart and core of the universe. And it's out of sexual power that we get the green grass and we get the bees and we get the other things that were on our list. So from Apsu and Tiamat come the six generations of the gods. And what's created in those six generations absolutely corresponds to what's created in the 6 days of Genesis. The major difference between the two stories is that Genesis has no role for sexual energy in God being the force of creation. But I'm wanting to get this idea that they're basing the model of God on their best available science. And out of that, coming up with a way of thinking about God. Another one is builder that I thought might come up on the list. So kings and rulers, one of their characteristic activities in the ancient world is to build cities. Because cities are the way in which the chaos of creation is overcome. Cities are the way in which civilization spreads and humanity brings its wisdom into the chaos of the wilderness. So in an ancient perspective, the function of Holden Village would be to tame the wilderness, to bring civilization into what is a chaotic, unstructured wilderness. Which is not the way we think about it, but that's how the ancient Babylonians and Sumerians would have thought about it. It's probably also the way in which the ancient Hebrews would have thought about it. God brings civilization through the structure of Jerusalem, through the structure of other cities that they were building and working to construct. In the oldest layers of the Old Testament, the sort of focus for all of this is to use the idea of God as a king. And so in the older layers of the New Testament, or Old Testament, we see that functioning in that way. In the later levels, what they begin to experience is so a king is like the ultimate power in the universe. Structures civilization, structures creation, builds cities, all that sort of stuff. When we get to books like Esther and some of the later stuff in the Old Testament, they're now experiencing an emperor as the ultimate power in the universe. The emperor is the Death Star. And it is an emperor who is probably remote and aloof and that nobody interacts with directly. The emperor operates through mediaries. In the biblical world, those are angels. God speaks to us through angels. God sends angels out to do the business. God is the aloof emperor up in heaven in his celestial imperial throne. Now, we would then find much of this transposed into the New Testament, where we find Jesus spoken of as the King of Kings, the Lord of Lords. They're doing a direct jump over from the way in which the Roman Emperor is thought about and applying that as a way and a model of trying to think about Jesus. But they're drawing it from their culture, they're drawing it from their experience, and then transposing it to God. So, shall we jump to the scientific revolution? These ways of thinking about God are what's fundamentally there in the Christian sort of toolbox for thinking about God, what we've done so far. Scientific revolution begins to absolutely change that. One of the things that happens, particularly with Newtonian physics, is to do away with the idea of an original chaos. So notice that in this story, there's stuff. There's no explanation of where the stuff came from, but the stuff is there, and creation is about giving order to chaos. The Hebrew story is the same. In the beginning, when God created the heavens and the earth was without form and void, and the Spirit of God hovered over the tahum vabohum, the chaotic primal waters. Genesis does not give us creation ex nihilo, creation out of nothing. It gives us God as a power working with chaotic gunk and shaping it into a structured, ordered universe. Newton sort of, no, that's not the way the universe works. There's no such thing as chaos in Newtonian physics. Everything is ordered, structured from the very basis of everything, and God is that fundamental primary order and structure. And so it's really in the scientific revolution that theology begins fundamentally to think of creation ex nihilo, creation out of nothing. So you have God and nothing else. And then God, no create, and then God just creates order and law. But notice that that order and law thing is still envisioning God as a king. So God becomes the cosmic mathematician. How many of you were math majors? Good. All right. I have a sister-in-law who is a math major, and I just don't understand her. I haven't passed a math course since third grade, so. But God is the cosmic mathematician. God is the lawgiver. So in Newtonian physics, everything is about scientific law. Where did those laws come from? Those laws were given by God. If we bring that over into human interactions, Immanuel Kant, who's sort of Newton's co-partner only in ethics and philosophy, God is the supreme ethical lawgiver. And human life is about discovering the laws of ethics that God has written into the structure of the universe. Now, these laws are universal, they're unchanging. The universe will follow these laws from beginning to end, and there is nothing in the universe, not a single atom, that does not follow these laws, absolutely and irrevocably. God is the ultimate micromanager. It's inescapable if your theology embraces a Newtonian view of the world or a Kantian view of ethics. In fact, one of the famous stories is that an advisor to Napoleon, Laplace is his last name, the concept is called Laplace's demon. Napoleon asked Laplace if his science needed God anywhere as a hypothesis. And Laplace replied, "Sir, I have no need of such a hypothesis." And Napoleon asked him why, and he said, "Well, if you can give me the location of every particle and the speed of every particle, I can compute everything that will ever happen. Every thought that will ever be in your mind, every action you will ever do, just give me the location and the speed of every single particle in the universe, and it will happen." It's called Laplace's demon. And of course, Laplace is actually talking about the way in which Christians imagine God to have total knowledge of every single facet, all the way down to subatomic particles in the universe. Enter. Well, let's apply that to theology. How many of you are Calvinists? Well, all right. There's one in every crowd. Actually, Lutherans are pretty much Calvinistic. They just don't admit it. Luther was pretty... Luther hemmed and hawed about predestination. But when confronted with Anabaptists who were free will, he was pretty much a Calvinist. So notice how this Newtonian revolution gives us a Calvinist God in Protestant theology. In Calvinism, God picked out your dirty socks this morning. those of you that are wearing socks. God is in absolute control of everything you will ever think, everything you will ever do, every feeling you will ever have. And so you're seeing how that connects with this sort of Newtonian view of the way in which physics work. The other thing that's going on here, which I think is really interesting, is about this same, a little later in the time period, more in the 17th century, we start with a whole idea that economics function on universal laws. The laws of economics. How many of you have heard that? The laws of the market, right? So we get Malthus and we get Adam Smith talking about market laws and tying in our economic human life, like Kant, ethics to the structure of the universe, Malthus and Adam Smith, economics to the structure of the universe, and we get God the supreme capitalist. We get God who rewards people who work really hard and earn lots of money. Which gets us the whole capitalist work ethic. If you're not working hard, you're not a good person. Comes out of this application of economic law to the structure of the universe. God loves competition. And God will reward success and hard work. We get economic Darwinism, in which God puts the laws of economics to sort us out into who are the good and the bad. Now, luckily we didn't stay there. Do I have general agreement on that? Okay. Luckily we didn't stay there. There's a second scientific revolution that begins with Darwin in the late 19th century and then culminates with Einstein at the beginning of the 20th century. Now, let's remember my premise that a model of God ought to accommodate what we know about the universe. So Newton thought that he knew the absolute mechanical, mathematical structures of the universe, and what we end up doing is we end up thinking about God to fit those. So if our premise is that we accommodate or adjust our models, in part because we know what God actually did. So we're back to the God as the artist, and when you look at the universe and you begin to do a scientific analysis, you begin to find out what God actually did, and that causes us to have to rethink some of our models. The one I like to do, and at this point I want to throw in creation science, particularly YEC, Young Earth Creationism. The universe was created about 6,000 years ago based on doing the genealogies and the years of Genesis. It was 6 24-hour, literally, days. It's called Young Earth Creationism. YEC is kind of a disparative thing, but it's Young Earth Creationism. And in Young Earth Creationism, the model of God is God as a magician. Borrowing this from Kenneth Miller's book, Finding Darwin's God. It's the best thing on the planet on evolution and theology, if you want to look at it. God is a magician. God just goes abracadabra, presto, change-o, and there's a star. God goes bingo, bango, wooka, mabuka, and there's a galaxy. The problem is that we now know how God makes galaxies. And we know from particularly the Hubble spacecraft how God makes stars. And so the idea would be that if, you all realize that Jesus quoted Abraham Lincoln. A house divided against itself cannot stand. We can't have contradictions in our view of God, where God becomes like, in Jesus' own teaching, a house that is divided and collapses. So the Young Earth Creationism, in my mind, begins to fail on that point. So you, God is a magician, but God's not acting like a magician right now. God doesn't make stars magically appear currently. The way they appear currently is following particular laws of gases and gravity, and condensation, and when the temperature gets high enough and the pressure gets high enough, they combust into a nuclear furnace, and then you've got a star. Now, how many of you are made of carbon? Well, this is good. None of you are aliens. All right. Trekkie again. Anybody remember Star Trek, the motion picture? Who's the bad guy? V'ger? Remember the Voyager spacecraft gets sucked through a black hole, gets changed into this big eat the galaxy thing, and it's coming back for us. And it's about ready to destroy humanity, and Kirk is trying to talk it out of it, and V'ger just goes, destroy carbon-based units, destroy carbon-based units. No, thank you. Luckily, Captain Kirk saved us all, and we're still here. But how does God make carbon? If I'm a young Earth creationist, it's just magic. God just says, let there be carbon. But we know from modern physics that carbon is being constructed inside of stars. And that you are actually made of stardust. Because the stars over a certain size eventually explode into supernovas, and in the process of the supernova, they make all elements heavier than iron in the periodic table. And actually, you need a little gold and zinc and stuff in there, right? That's why you take a daily vitamin, is to get those trace elements that are part of life. And which means that you got to have a couple generations of stars before you can get planets with concentrations of the necessary elements to create life. We can't have a house divided against itself where God goes, magic, here's carbon. Oh, but that's not how I really want to do it. I really want to do it inside of stars. So I'll throw out one of my first sort of ways in which I think science leads us to think about God. God's a cook, and stars are the ovens. And in those ovens, God cooks up the stuff of life and spews it out through, so he's a wasteful cook, okay? Spews it out through the universe, and some of that stuff coalesces into really, really good, what were those muffins we had? I forgot what they were now. Everybody had a muffin, didn't they, at lunch? Okay. We're what God cooks. And I find it a really useful sort of starting point, at least, to think about some of the impacts of modern science on how we view God. Now, it's not a model that's... I don't think it's anywhere in the Old Testament, is it? God is a cook? She's an Old Testament person. It's not in the New Testament, that I know of, but it's so rich. God's a cook. How many of you cook? And you take care over it, right? You want to do it good. You want people to enjoy what you have prepared. Sometimes you want to get exotic and create Minnesotans. God is a cook, and here and there are probably little islands of finished product that have blossomed into life. Or, because I think God has interests that go far beyond us, there are probably other places in the universe where that recipe has cooked up things that we have absolutely no imagination about, or probably much of any way of relating to. So that's the first one I'm going to throw out there. So let's look then a little bit more specifically at how evolution specifically, should we recap just a little bit of evolutionary theory and then take a break at 4? Okay. We've already done a little bit of it. Evolution starts in stars, where you create carbon and you create elements beyond that. Then you have to have this whole process of star formation that pulls those things into a new star and has enough stuff left over to make rocky planets. At least we think that's what you need, are rocky planets. Watery rocky planets. Watery rocky planets with enough heat and at the Goldilocks zone away from a star. All of those things are the physics basis of the theory of evolution. But when you get a place where that stuff comes together, where you get the pot with the right elements in it, life happens. Or at least it happened here. There are all sorts of, we scientifically don't know how it got started. There are lots of different mechanisms. Probably one of the most reasonable right now, correct me Joe if I'm wrong, but is deep sea thermal vents, I would say, is sort of way up there on the probability of where, because you've got energy, you've got heat, you've got concentrations of the minerals and stuff, and you can create, get these systems with self-reproducing small organisms. And when we go down to the deep sea thermal vents in between the continents, we find all kinds of life. They are rich for life. Darwin, of course, thought of the sort of warm, gooey tidal pool, where you've got water with the stuff in it and it sits there and does it. That one's not very popular anymore. Another interesting one is in caves, where you would have pyrite formations. So you need something to structure the organic molecules, and they bind to the pyrite and get structure, and then somehow start reproducing. Another one, really interesting one, is under ice. That the ice provides a crystalline structure that the molecules bond to, and then, but it gets started some way. And it takes a long, long time to do anything interesting. For a couple billion years, all we've got are little microbes. Single, not even single-celled things, just the bare bones of reproductive DNA. Then it takes a huge long amount of time for those little guys to learn how to merge into a true cellular structure with multiple internal components. Life is at that level already a community, in which I think the best theory right now is that you've got all these different microbes. They're not competing. Darwin gets his competition from that economic capitalist god. They're not competing, they're cooperating and learning how to begin to structure, first of all, complex cellular life, and then multicellular life. So inside of you, you've got your little mitochondria guys. Inside of every cell, your little mitochondria are your furnaces. They burn the energy that functions in your cells. And like if you're a lowlander like me, they get used to not needing as much oxygen, and then you get up here and they say, oh man, you're going to make us reproduce and grow in here. They actually have a completely different DNA than you do. Inside of every single cell you have is an alien species, a mitochondria, that you require in order to be able to live. It's amazing. Life is cooperative at that level, at all levels, probably, rather than the competition model that Darwin or post-Darwinist favored. The correct language is orthodox Darwinists favor competition still. Once life breaks out into learning how to become multicellular, it just goes wild. And we get the Cambrian explosion, in which life is playing with dozens of different sort of body plans and all sorts of things. But all of this is happening randomly through mutation. Mutations can be as much as a point mutation on a DNA, which is a quantum event. They can be caused by a random hit of a photon from the sun, which is why we all have to watch out about skin cancer. All of these changes happen in a random sort of way, so randomness. The other major feature in evolution is, in my mind, that's important for us to think about, is the contingency, the randomness of macro events. So why, but this is a really interesting, why are you not all intelligent velociraptors sitting here today listening to me?
Because they all got wiped out.
They got wiped out 65 million years by a chance hit of an asteroid on our planet. Now, from Jurassic Park, you all know how intelligent velociraptors were. They were smart little boogers. And they had opposing claws. So they, like, our gift is we can use our thumbs to manipulate tools. They were going to be able to do it. And they already were starting brains. If there hadn't been that asteroid, intelligent life could have been through dinosaurs. There have been 5 mass extinctions. We're now currently in the 6th, which we're causing ourselves. 5 mass extinctions, all random events that sift life out. And so what evolution, so we get the randomness of changes in a population. Everybody's different. Nobody in here is alike. We heard that last night, right? We're all unique. We're all different. We're all our own gift to the universe. We're all expressing God in a way that no other human can possibly express God. It's that randomness and that variation that allows a species to adapt when there's one of these events. And what evolution does is select for the most adaptable species, not the strongest. And that natural selection is a law-like feature. So we get randomness in tension with lawfulness. Now, John Polkinghorne, I talked about him, right? Anglican, Cambridge, thinks that this is really the whole center of all the questions we're asking. That God, first of all, God has structured a universe in which there's this novelty, newness, unexpectedness, randomness that comes up in a non-predictable manner, sorted through by a lawfulness, so that you get a balance between randomness and stability. It's always interesting to ask this question of college students, but for this group, how many of you absolutely thrive on total chaos? That's your best productivity, is total chaos. I always get a few college students go, yeah, me. Okay, that explains some things about your grade. We thrive in structure. So life, which is producing these random variations, thrives in the structure that's produced on a stable planet and is sorted through the lawful mechanisms of natural selection, a balance. And that's going to have fundamental implications for how we try to think about God. A God who is both lawful and, somebody said, playful. Enter, so that's our first totally new sort of way of thinking about God. We should take 5-10 minutes. You should get up, move, go get a cup of coffee, but be back here in 10 minutes. So let's go. See what we do. So the second major revolution comes out of Einstein's theories of relativity, and relativity, to my mind, forces us to do some thinking about the relationship between God and time. But that's another course. What's more interesting is that Einstein's original breakthrough, which was on the photovoltaic effect, proved the existence of the quantum world and was the basis for quantum physics, quantum cosmology. And so to work into how that forces us to change our thinking about God, we need to cover just a little bit of sort of a review of quantum weirdness.
God is weird.
Well, yeah. So Niels Bohr, one of the fathers of quantum mechanics, once said that if you think you understand quantum mechanics, you're wrong. And another famous quote is that not only is the universe strange, the universe is stranger than we can imagine. So the Greeks turned out to be wrong. Atoms are not the smallest possible things. Atoms can be divided, as we know from the atomic bomb, and atoms are composed of electrons, neutrons, and protons. Now, you can't break down an electron or a photon, but you can break down protons and neutrons into quarks. And it's at that, when you get down to that level, that there's just strange stuff going on. From my modeling of God, the most important is the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. So you remember Laplace's demon. If you give me the location of every particle and its speed, I will predict everything that's going to happen. God didn't make that kind of universe. The Heisenberg uncertainty principle states that if I know the location of an electron, I cannot know its speed. If I know its speed, I cannot know its location. Alright? Now that relates, that there are two possible explanations. One is it's a measurement problem. So that when you're trying to locate an electron and you do the measurement to locate it, you add energy to it and that changes its speed, so therefore you couldn't know the speed if you know where it is. And if you're looking for its speed, you're going to change, your measurement's going to change its location, so you don't know where it is. Now, this is still an open question, but in the books that I read, I'm going to guess that 95% of all physicists don't think it's a measurement problem. This is the way the universe is. And I'm helped to think about it by Heisenberg got this with the whole process of a wave equation. So you take a subatomic particle, you can write an equation which will chart as a wave. Wave equations are deterministic, and they deal with a probability from zero to zero with a sort of 100% there. And what they measure is the likelihood. This is not a good one. They measure the likelihood that an electron will be in a specific place on the wave equation or at a specific speed. But you cannot know with certainty where the electron is going to appear when you make the measurement. It could. So right at this very moment, you've got a couple of electrons loose on the other side of the moon. So we used to get those commercials on TV. Parents, do you know where your children are? Do you know where your electrons are? Okay. Please take better care of your electrons. Now, that's a pretty low probability. It would be very bad for you if all your electrons suddenly shunted off to the far side of the moon. But it's just, you've got so many billions upon billions upon trillions of them that few of them can go off, nothing happens. But it's totally unpredictable. It's unknown whether or not they're going to do that. So what you get is simply a probabilistic account of where a particular electron or subatomic particle is going to be. Similarly, you get a probabilistic account of its speed. Now, one of the ways that I find it's helpful to think about this is that because of the Greeks, we want to find the tiniest little pieces of stuff. String theory helped me realize this. What if there are no pieces? All there is a wave of energy. The wave is what's real. And when you make a measurement, what you get is a perturbation in the wave equation, so that it appears as though the electron's there. But that's just kind of a little pssst in the wave. And as soon as you're not looking at your electron, it goes back to being nowhere. Wave-particle duality. Waves cannot be particles, and particles cannot be waves. These are mutually exclusive categories, logically inconsistent. But yet, every single experiment that's ever been run, an electron is both at the same time. If you look at it and you look for wave qualities, you get wave qualities. Now, this blows my mind. So I do an experiment, and I come up with a wave. And then I figure out a way to change the experiment after I actually did it. Go back. I've got a second set of instruments that go back and change the conditions. And the electron will have behaved like a particle. It will do both at the same time. You can do other... So I've got an electron gun. Electron guns shoot one electron at a time. And I've got a screen with a hole in it, right? So the electron goes through the hole in the screen. That makes sense. But if I change the experiment and I block after the fact, I can do this. I don't know how that works. And I shot an electron, and that one single electron took every possible course to the screen. I'm not supposed to get it. I'm supposed to be going like that, right? So there's wave-particle duality, superpositioning, which is the whole thing that an electron can be both a wave and a particle at the same time. Classic one of this is Schrodinger's cat. Now Schrodinger originally came up with the cat analogy to disprove quantum indeterminacy, the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, because he and Einstein did not like it. What's Einstein's famous comment? The old man does not play dice, and old man is his word for God. He was disturbed by the idea of randomness in the universe, and so Schrodinger came up with a cat. It was supposed to show this to be so bizarre as to be illogical, and of course Niels Bohr said, that's it. And the Niels Bohr interpretation of Schrodinger's cat. So, Schrodinger's cat. I hope none of you are cat lovers.
Yes.
I mean, I'm a dog person married to a cat person, so what happens? Cat owners? All right, this is purely a thought experiment, all right? Okay, so I take a cat, I put it in a box inside the, I can't see into the box, it's an opaque box. Inside is a vial of poison gas and a Geiger counter and a piece of uranium, some radioactive material with a predictable half-life, all right? At some point in time, that radioactive material is going to send out a little thingy, and the little thingy is going to click a thing that releases the poison gas and kills the cat. I can't know until I look in the box. So the question is, what is the state of the cat before I look? When I look, the cat's either alive or dead. It's in one state on the wave or another. But the most popular interpretation of this is that when before I open the box, the cat is in a ghost-like state. It's neither alive or dead, or it's both alive and dead. And it collapses into a particular state when we make the analysis. Now, where I want to go with this is that so John Polkinghorne, why has John Polkinghorne been important? This is your quiz. Polkinghorne pairs lawfulness with randomness to explain God acting in the universe. God provides stability, but God also provides a system that sort of does its own thing to get novelty, and it's those two interacting. So Schrodinger's cat gives us the same thing. There's this, quantum mechanics gives us this random, indeterministic universe at its base, which also follows a lawful mathematical expression. Again, that balance between lawfulness and sort of, let's begin to call it creativity. The other one that's really interesting is at the Planck scale, time dissolves into space, and space kind of acts time-like. So you can get effects that precede their causes at the quantum level. And this, and tunneling, I mean, your electrons can tunnel. Can move from one place to the other without having gone through the intervening space, through microscopic Planck level wormholes. Space is interconnected in that way, and that may create this space-time froth, is the way they speak of it, in which there's no longer a sort of time sequence of stuff. It's whoa, right? So, let's play with modeling this. Lawfulness, regularity, randomness, chance. How's this sound? God as a jazz composer. Now, I've been using the jazz composer model now for 25 years, but I never published it. Philip Clayton did publish it, so if you want to say somebody, you got to say Philip Clayton. Jazz composer. So tell me what you know about jazz.
Improvisation.
Any old improvisation? Unstructured? Now, there is some really out there jazz that is totally unstructured improvisation. But most jazz is an identifiable piece in which the players improvise. That seems to be the kind of universe we live in.
But they improvise in such a way that they can work against each other and with each other.
Yeah, and so can we.
Yeah.
So you get the idea of God creating a universe out of which a sort of, so how about if we think about it this way? God sort of sets out keys. I find it really interesting that you can take, there's some kind of wave that came out of the Big Bang, and you can turn it into sound. I've listened to it on my computer, and it what it sounds like is one of those Tibetan monk things. There's a sound to creation, a key. I think there are possibly ways in which you can think of evolution as providing various sorts of resonance is a physics idea for the interactions. If physics is the basis of chemistry, chemistry is the basis of biochemistry, biochemistry is the basis of life, then life follows certain resonances, but there's huge parts of the score that are just improv. and creation does its own thing. If I try to play with this biblically, okay, so and I feedback here is more than welcome. Genesis, God says, what's God's repetitive phrase through those days of Genesis?
Let there be.
Let there be. Followed by, God looked at it, it was good.
It was good.
Now, in my mind, we now have an absolute identification of God. God is Paul McCartney. Let it be, let it be, let it be, yeah, let it be. Let it happen. Fretheim, what's his first name?
Terry
Fretheim. Terrence Fretheim plays with this idea in his analysis of Genesis that what you get is God saying to the earth, let there be life. And then God backs off and life happens on its own, in its own way, improvising on that initial sort of resonance that comes out of chemistry and biochemistry. Physics seems to work that way. God, this I'm borrowing from Kenneth Miller's book. Kenneth Miller uses it in his closing, the idea that God throws out a universe, which then large, but there are structures to that. And then within those structures, that universe largely makes itself.
Is that kind of a deist approach to things, or is deism?
Well, so I think that's a perfect question. I struggle with that one. So then I want it to be not just the jazz composer, sort of like Miles Davis, right? All right, no. Who wrote a piece and then he's just sitting there watching other people do it. I think we would want to imagine God as the composer who's also playing in the piece. And there we're immensely helped by process theology, which is a I hope we'll get to that. But other feedback on the moment in both evolution and in physics for the creation of the universe. God as this jazz composer in which the universe largely sort of does its own thing. And God is just sort of, oh man, that is one fabulous riff up there that the Milky Way is doing. How's that strike you?
I like it.
How's it challenge you?
Freedom.
Well, I think that we finally have an answer. This is my own theological riff here. I think we finally have an answer to the question of free will. God did not create a deterministic universe. It's simply not. Now, it's very important that we understand that randomness is not the same as free will, choice. But the way in which I would say it is randomness is a necessary, though not sufficient, cause of free will. If there's no randomness, if everything is absolutely, every movement of every particle is absolutely predetermined, I don't see any way a philosopher can get free will. But if at the very base there is this freedom in creation, then that freedom has the chance to evolve into the kind of freedom that you and I have. Now, where I think that translates is that God watches my life and occasionally I surprise him. I mean, right? So if I am a wave equation, and I could be a wave equation, you can describe yourself with a wave equation. God's pretty, I'm really betting you're going to be a jerk tomorrow. And then I get up and I surprise God by not kicking the dog. Or grumping at the neighbor across the street before I have my coffee. Martin, I never would have thought you could get through and be nice to somebody before coffee. which is a real challenge here because I got to walk all the way over here to get it. Are you following me? I can surprise God. I can disappoint God. Now, on Friday, I'm going to deal with anthropocentrism, the way in which we think the story is all about us. But on this model, the story is simply about the universe here and there and lots of possible... I mean, there's at least 200 billion galaxies, each with 500 billion stars. If God, as we had on our original list, loves life, if God is Tevye, L'chaim, L'chaim, to life, it's pretty hard to imagine God wasting all of those other galaxies for nothing. So the idea would be that it's not that God had Homo sapiens in mind when creating the universe. God threw out a universe that was going to create structured planets and solar systems. God threw out a universe in which the laws of physics moved to the laws of chemistry, to biochemistry, to life. And I think, I hope we don't disagree on this one, I think that the laws of biology eventually create an intelligence race, right? Because the nature of all evolution is to explore niches. Life is going to go into some place where there's not competition, where that's not being used. And once you fill up lots of different environmental niches, what's left is an intelligence exploration. Now, I read about some computer studies of evolutionary models where they run a whole bunch of different starting points on dozens of different planets. And what this particular study found was that in about 3 out of 10 evolutionary models eventually create intelligent life. So if the idea is that the universe is created by God with I'm being God here, I can't help it. Somewhere out there, they're going to be feeling, emotive, self-aware beings. And I'm waiting for them. Now, that they showed up on the third rock from the sun, wow, I would never have guessed they'd be out there in the arm of the Milky Way. But they're probably all over the place. And so Kenneth Miller says it this way. Wherever such beings come into existence, they may view themselves as the express will of God. Which is, of course, how our Christian theology phrases it. We are the purpose of creation. Well, there's probably some intelligent Romulans somewhere who have a similar theology. And Miller's brilliance, I think, for his book is to say that wherever that happens, those beings have the right to think of themselves as the purpose of God's creation. Which, of course, if we ever do confirm that there's ET out there somewhere, it's going to force us to rethink some of that anthropocentrism, which is what I want to focus on Friday.
Purpose versus the purpose?
God, I would think God has other purposes that we don't know about.
Yeah.
So okay. I'm happy with the language a purpose rather than the purpose, but that's hard for most believers to go that far.
Yeah, well, it's about the animal kingdom.
Yeah. Well, if it's about self-awareness, then there are other species, clearly, that are self-aware.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Right.
Whales, porpoises, chimpanzees, gorillas. I'm not sure. Somewhere further down this whole process of aware of me begins. I mean, I think my cats are aware that they want to be in control. No, you will do what I want you to do. So yes, other purposes clearly. So on Friday I'm gonna work with the idea of Paul Santmeier's. I'm trying to do our theology as cosmocentric rather than anthropocentric. Go with Edward O. Wilson's idea that we're created initially to be biophiles, to love life, all of life, any life. And we're now in cultural structures and particularly urban structures that are dissevering our connection to other life. At the extreme of that is this whole new movement of transhumanism or posthumanism. Are those words? Kurzweiler, lost his first name. So the singularity.
Right.
That moment when computers match human neural activity, computing ability. The idea is that you will then be able to download your mental life into a computer. Kurzweiler is trying to keep himself alive to get to that point and live in a machine, finally, completely, totally disconnected from biology.
Man.
Without a need for any other living thing in a computer.
Wasn't there a Star Trek episode about that?
Yes, yes. It's a common theme in more than one Star Trek. And it's also the sort of data thing. All right. Not really reincarnation. Well, it is a form of, you're incarnate into this computer program. But, okay, so if creation improvises, God gives us this freedom to sort of do our own thing. Here are some ways in which it becomes perhaps theologically acceptable for us. How many of you are curious? This allows God to be curious. What's going to happen? On the Newtonian model, God knows everything. God knows everything that's ever going to happen. There's no curiosity. On this model, God can share your curiosity about what is going to unfold in terms of the development and the history of the universe. God can be surprised, right? I was talking about the way in which when I get up and I'm nice before coffee, God is probably just going, oh man, he pulled that one over on me. How many of you love to be surprised? Isn't it better to think of God also valuing surprise? Wonder. This is a model in which God looks at this universe that he threw out there and it's just, wow. Right?
Kind of throws out the window everything, all of those omnis we apply to God, omniscience, omnipresence. And...
Or it forces us to redefine what they mean.
There'd be a lot of really the more fundamental Christians among us who say that, you know, would say that God knows everything, and
that it violates the Bible.
Inviolable, can't be.
But then I'm going to have to. Well, first of all, I'm going to have to deal with that. That's not the kind of universe God made, and deal with that problem theologically. And then I think I'm also going to eventually have to deal with restricting the fact that that model restricts God's emotive relationship to the universe. So God could be anticipation, play. God, this sense of, right, in jazz, the composer does this little riff and then he sees how you deal with it and how the saxophonist deals with it and what the bass player does with it. And then, okay, so how about if I this little part? Let's see how you play with that. I find it just a wonderful, rich sort of way of trying to think about God's relationship. Fundamentally, what it does in terms of creation is that it throws out this idea of God creating a universe of possibilities, the wave equation. And then God stepping back and sort of aesthetically happy and pleased with the universe exploring these different possibilities. Isn't that what we all want for our kids? We want to equip them, but we then want them to go out and explore life. And it's a wonderful journey. I mean, sometimes it's scary as hell when they don't go where you think they should go, or they go into destructive patterns, but that's part of the risk. So this is God as a risk taker. But when they do, it's just a wonderful just to see how they navigate life, how they surprise you. All of those parental qualities that I think we value in ourselves, this kind of model allows us to begin valuing those kinds of qualities as a way in which we're like God. Right? We're in the image of God. So if I'm curious, is that not part of God? If I'm playful, is that not part of God? If I can be surprised, is that not part of God? It really helps me. Now, here's what I think is the biggest drawback. Remember the Old Testament models that we had there? A lot of them focused around
protection.
That one bothers me. I'm a little on this model, I'm a little bit out there on my own. Because not the second greatest problem I think that theology faces is in light of modern science, where is there room for God to stick his finger in the pudding? Lots of people have suggested a lot of different ways in which we might understand God to get his finger in the pudding and steer it around. I want a jazz composer who didn't just set the score and then back off, but who is involved in the score, in the actual play. Modern science poses some real challenges to that. Now, if I end up with a God, deistic, I think you said that earlier, who writes the score and then just sits back to see what happens, I'm feeling a little frightened because I'm not that great a player. Okay, it's easy for me to screw up. And screw up brings consequences. Disharmony in the music. I don't remember who brought that up. I think it was you.
Lack of structure.
But if I can figure out a way within, particularly it's physics, I think, that's the greater problem than biology. If I can figure out a way in physics that the universe is open to God playing through it, that maybe I can get the security. So when I'm struggling with my riff and I'm doing all sorts of things that are out of key, is there a way I can imagine God as this other player coming over and say, you know, let me help you with that. Let's try this out. That seems to work for me. Joe? Is that a...
I think we can can understand biology, right? We know a lot about biology, reproduction, laws of ecology, and environmental science and all. The physics and what you're describing today take us in a different direction, right?
Well, there's an awful lot of unknowns yet in the physics stuff.
But there's also, correct me if I'm wrong, isn't there in physics also the sense that there are experiments that change if they're observed or not?
Yep.
So maybe God
and the results change.
So God can be interacting. I mean, that means that you're interacting with the universe. You can never really remove yourself from the universe. So we have a God who's interactive.
So if physicists don't have answers to this theology, there are some theologians who have been trying to think this through. Where I want to close is a little commercial for what's called process theology. In feminist theology, you get this concept of the universe is God's body. And that feeds into process. I keep picking up the bad ones. And that fits into process theology as panentheism. Panentheism is not pantheism. So most of us grew up hearing about Hindus being pantheistic and how bad that was. And pantheism says that the universe is God. God is the universe. There's an equation there. Take all the parts of the universe and you got God, and that's it. So your binoculars are God, the chair is God, I'm God, you put us all together, we're God. Panentheism says that God is the universe plus. The universe is God, but God is more than the universe. The universe is like God's. So the analogy is the way in which you have a mind, which is a process of your brain, but your mind runs a body and is in and through a body. God is this extra quality that manifests through the universe as God's body. It's an analogy, right? Okay. Now, the other thing that's really interesting about process theology is the idea of God as a lure. Got any trout fishermen here? Someday I'm going to learn how to fly fish. It's on my bucket list, and I got to get started on that list because there's not a lot of time.
You can take a class about fly fishing. Flying. Mm-hmm.
There is a class?
There is a class about tying flies.
I got to learn how to do this without ripping the seat of my pants out. So in process theology, the way in which God plays in the jazz is as, so if you're my wind section and you're my percussion section, and here's the score is being read out in front of you, God is ahead of you in the score saying, come this way, come this way. I want you to play in this. Now you can choose not to do that. You can say, no, I don't. I think it's going to sound better if I go this way. And then God will be over here luring you. So the idea is that God has an end point for the piece that is the universe. There will be a sort of final crescendo and everything come together into that obvious closing of the music. But in between, we're all playing our own thing, and God is trying to lure us toward that ending. Now, in Alfred North Whitehead's philosophy, this extends all the way down to the states in which quantum particles fall out. God is luring your electrons to be in a particular place. Some of them may resist and go different places, but at every moment of every piece of the universe, all the way to the quantum level to galaxies, God is luring everything in the universe toward a conclusion. The universe, some bits follow God's enticement, God's lure. Other bits decide to go in different directions. But God is active in the piece in this way. Now, most physicists that I know don't like Whitehead. but it's really interesting theology to think of it in that kind of processual sort of way.
Final sounds questions. Like a thoughts. Sort of predeterminism for quantum theology.
The wave equation is deterministic, mm-hmm. but the specific point that, so I still think it's open-ended, less than deterministic. If there's determinism, it's the quantum mini-worlds thing, which just...
So how does string theory and multiverse fit in?
true. Well, as we all know from Sheldon on Big Bang Theory, string theory is no longer where it's at. String theory looked like it was just going to sweep the field in the 90s. My understanding is that the problem with string theory is it has literally hundreds of millions of different possible solutions. And nobody can decide which one actually fits the universe. Now, it could be that those hundreds of millions of different possibilities are for hundreds of millions of different universes. So here's the, who is it? There's a Nobel Prize winner, physicist, who thinks that multiverse theory is non-scientific. In other words, in science, you have to be able to make predictions, and your predictions have to be able to be falsified, or at least not work out. But multiverse theory predicts everything, and therefore excludes nothing, and is non-testable. Because in multiverse theory, there's another universe where there's an exact you listening to me say this exact thing at this exact moment. And there are universes where people walk on water as a regular event. There are universes where all births are virgin births. There's a universe where there's a universe where Johnny Depp is a real pirate.
And where velociraptors are the intelligent.
Yeah. So since multiverse theory, by playing with infinity,
right,
predicts everything and excludes nothing, this cadre of scientists are saying it's not scientific. Plus, it's pretty impossible that we would be able to verify the existence of any of these other universes. By definition, they're so separate that we could never communicate. Those are the problems. Now, theologically, why couldn't God throw out billions upon billions of universes, right? If God's a jazz composer, is a jazz composer limited to one piece? Maybe God... So, theologically, I don't really have a problem with multiverse. But I think that there's a growing scientific resistance to multiverse.
In this kind of a theory that you're going toward here, does that mean that Satan's not necessary anymore?
Well, there were... I don't know that he ever was.
Evil is just another possible path that...
Satan, the way in which you and I understand Satan, is a latecomer to theology. He's nowhere in nearly any of the Old Testament until you get to the book of Job.
Yeah, so what I was thinking about was the Job thing is
And the book of Job
is... Is it really irrelevant whether good things happen to... Bad things happen to good people or good things happen to bad people.
And in the book of Job, he's not really Satan the way we understand it. He's sort of God's district attorney. Not the opposition. He does show up in the teaching of Jesus as this demonic figure. He shows up in the book of Revelation. But those are developments in intertestamental Judaism that become part of the toolbox that Jesus has as a human being, as the other New Testament writers have as human beings.
But is that unnecessary if you think about it, like quantum physics or something like that?
My theological instinct is that you and I are capable of creating enough evil. Right? I mean, the Holocaust, the Shoah. I don't know that we need Satan to do that. We just need somebody like Hitler and a bunch of hatred and stereotyping spread across several generations. Now, if you want to call that Satan, that's okay, but I'm not sure we need to think of him as a guy with horns and a tail and leading the opposition.
So it's kind of obsolete.
Possibly, yeah. Now, I'm doing some work in the book of Revelation where if we understand angels to be social forces, given personalities, maybe Satan functions something like that. But again, it's our own ability to do evil, which comes to us, honestly, through evolution. Causes enough trouble on its own. Maybe Satan's a cop-out, right? Anybody remember Flip Wilson?
A devil made me do it!
Which is the only thing of Flip Wilson I can remember, but he was on TV every week. Okay, I think I've kept you 7 minutes over. There will be additional tuition charges.
Thank you.